from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Poet Elizabeth Bishop once famously told fellow poet Robert Lowell that when you write my epitaph, you must say I was the loneliest person who ever lived. Bishop must have understood what it was to be lonely. She was an infant when her father died and a child when her mother was institutionalized. And Pulitzer Prize-winning author Megan Marshall sheds light on the life and legacy of the poet in her new book, Elizabeth Bishop, A Miracle for Breakfast. And in this half-hour segment, Megan Marshall, a former student of Elizabeth Bishop's, joins us to talk about the very private and reticent poet. And delighted to have you. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Well, I've long been a fan of Elizabeth Bishop, but she has recently become, as I said before we came to this segment, high on the literary stock exchange, much more than perhaps even she would have imagined. She is much lionized now.
Yeah, she is. You know, she always knew her own worth, but often felt that it was discounted at the time. She's found her way onto a U.S. postage stamp. She's been the subject of movies, of novels. I think that her private life, even though she was a very private poet, has kind of elevated her status. We want to know more about her. And I felt really lucky to have this opportunity to write a new biography at a time when a whole group of her letters were discovered. We now know a great deal more about her childhood, thanks to letters that she wrote to her psychoanalyst when she was in her late 30s. We also understand three wonderful relationships with women that in much greater detail. So it really was time for a new biography. There hadn't been one in almost 25 years.
I have to almost reflexively ask you about the letters to the psychoanalyst because there was a big brouhaha over Anne Sexton's biography done by Diane Middlebrook because there was material used from her psychotherapy.
Yes, yeah. Is it appropriate to use these letters?
It's a big question. Yeah.
And, you know, Elizabeth Bishop did not have a daughter the way Anne Sexton did, who was controlling these letters. They emerged from the estate of her late life partner, Alice Methvessel, who was much younger. Alice died in 2009, and these papers appeared. I'll have to admit, you know, because I had been a student of Elizabeth Bishop, I knew what a private person she was. She was always Miss Bishop to me. And when I first found these letters...
And you were Miss Marshall to her.
I was. When I found these letters in the archive a few years ago, I started to cry. I thought, you know, would she want this? On the other hand, I was not the first person to read these letters. I knew somebody was going to use them, and I wanted to use them as responsibly as I could. Aside from some really disturbing and maybe not all that surprising, inspiring tales of her early love life, but sad things about her childhood. There were wonderful records of certain poems that she was writing at the time, At the Fish Houses and The Moose, which she didn't finish for many years. I felt these letters were incredibly valuable, if only for her discussion of the way she wrote her poetry, and that at this time in her mid to late 30s, she was beginning to see her poems as all one poem, she said. She didn't publish too many, only about 100.
About 100, yeah.
And that kind of makes sense. Maybe it is all one.
Well, you mentioned poem. At the Fish Houses, we happen to have a recording of her reading it.
Yeah, it'd be
maybe
great
you
to
can
hear
set
that.
This up for us.
So yeah, well, in the late 1940s, when she was seeing the psychoanalyst Ruth Foster, she was really at a low ebb. She'd had a drinking problem for quite a while. She'd been living in Key West and two different female lovers.
Forgive me, she had a drinking problem her whole life pretty much,
yes,
didn't she?
Yes,
and addictions,
yes,
of opioids and so many problems.
Well, maybe not so much opioids, but uppers, diet pills and antidepressants. But yeah, drinking was a problem since starting at the end of college, which is something that is revealed in these letters. So, but in the late 1940s, she decided, perhaps because she was in analysis, to go back to Nova Scotia, where her mother had been institutionalized when Bishop was age 5, and to try to look for documents of what had become of her mother, her hospital records. It's not clear what she found, but she got drunk yet again, and one morning in a kind of hangover state, took a long bicycle ride along the coast and landed at this harbor, Lockport. And she says in the letter to the psychoanalyst, "Then I saw this poem at the fish house."
Saw it visually.
Yes.
Let's listen to the opening of this poem. It's At the Fish Houses. It's read at the Library of Congress by Elizabeth Bishop back in 1974. And here she points, as Megan Marshall pointed out, a pretty vivid picture of the east coast of Nova Scotia.
"Although it's a cold evening, down by one of the fish houses, an old man sits netting. His net, in the gloaming almost invisible, a dark purple brown, and his shuttle worn and polished. The air smells so strong of codfish it makes one's nose run and one's eyes water. The five fish houses have steeply peaked roofs and narrow cleated gangplanks slant up to storerooms in the gables for the wheelbarrows to be pushed up and down on. All is silver, the heavy surface of the sea swelling slowly as if considering spilling over is opaque. But the silver of the benches, the lobster pots and masts scattered among the wild jagged rocks is of an apparent translucence, like the small old buildings with an emerald moss growing on their shoreward walls. The big fish tubs are completely lined with layers of beautiful herring scales, and the wheelbarrows are similarly plastered with creamy, iridescent coats of mail, with small iridescent flies crawling on them.
Well, you do get a sense from that of just what she could do with imagery, but also what she could do with just observation.
It's lovely that your audience is getting to hear her voice. Howard Moss, her editor at The New Yorker, said her poetry, it's as if you could wrap joy in mystery and somehow make it the subject of small talk. You hear that kind of familiarity, the familiar voice. But this poem leads to a really extraordinary conclusion, which she describes in the letter to her psychoanalyst as being about the process of psychoanalyst. She says, starts talking about the cold, dark, deep, absolutely clear water. If you tasted it, it would first taste bitter, then briny, then surely burn your tongue. It is like what we imagine knowledge to be. Dark, salt, clear, moving, utterly free, drawn from the cold, hard mouth of the world, derived from the rocky breasts forever, flowing and drawn, and since our knowledge is historical, flowing and flown.
Yeah. Extraordinary sense of observation and of meticulousness and precision. One of our great poets by far, I think, it's safe to say. And yet, you're bringing her life into this whole picture. You know, there was a whole attitude, thanks to T.S. Eliot and so many others, Ezra Pound, that she pretty much was under the suasion of. Yours truly would have to be included as well.
Yeah.
That said, you know, keep the author and the text separate. You know, look at the work and judge by the work. That's formalism. That's what was called New Criticism for years, and there was a kind of obeisance almost to the idea of New Criticism.
Yeah.
So what about, I mean, could we have a new biography of Robert Lowell, which works with his manic depression and says this is how you can understand his poetry? Mm-hmm. Some would be very resistant to that, I think.
Well, you know, I'm not saying this is how to understand her poetry, how we have to understand her poetry. My aim was to write the poetry back into the life. I think there's a great deal of curiosity, and legitimately so, about what was going on for a person as she was writing these great poems. It doesn't mean, you know, you can't appreciate them separate from the life, but her poems were, although they were not confessional in the sense of Robert Lowell, they often were based on autobiographical facts, and she said as much. She said this was all true. This all had happened to her. I think this was one of the reasons I felt in this book, it's kind of got an experimental structure. I also write about my own little experiences with Elizabeth Bishop as a student in her last poetry writing class that she taught at Harvard in 1976. It's my effort, I think, to be a kind of stand-in to bring the reader closer to Elizabeth Bishop in these encounters that I had, and also to pose myself as a kind of learner of poetry. One of my hopes for this book is that it will bring people to Bishop's poetry, to poetry in general. You don't have to be a literary critic to know and understand poetry, and that's why I think the life is important.
Well, I share your sentiments, and by the way, our guest Megan Marshall took a verse writing class at Harvard from Elizabeth Bishop back in 1977, and does bring a lot of her own experience and her kind of own memoirization into the mix here. It's ironic in some ways, though, that Elizabeth Bishop, at least when Mae Swenson and Adrienne Rich and others asked her to be included in anthologies of women poets, recoiled.
Yeah.
She didn't want to be classified or siloed as a woman poet.
Yeah. I think part of it, you know, you can see it in this mid-century modernism that she was part of, women painters also felt the same way. They were aware that they were breaking into a kind of all-male setting, and to call attention to their femininity, their womanliness, was going to perhaps discount their accomplishment. And so Mae Swenson wrote to her, urging her to be part of this. You know, the women's movement was coming on. Women poets were gaining a great deal from collectivity. She said, you know, urged her to be in this anthology that was going to be called The Woman Poets in English, and it was going to be very authoritative. But Bishop writes back, why not Men Poets in English? Don't you see how silly it is? And then this is what I really love, and I think it says a lot about her poetry as well as her response to this quest. She says, I like black and white, yellow and red, young and old, rich and poor, and male and female, all mixed up. Literature is literature, no matter who produces it.
So perhaps even though it's become so important to understanding her work in your book and by many people's lights now that she was a lesbian, she probably wouldn't have liked that silo either, one would assume.
No, not at all. I think particularly not. In fact, her last poem, there's a great deal of controversy about it, called Sonnet. And it ends, it's a very free-form kind of sonnet, very brief, and it ends with the word gay. And some people have felt, this was came out in 1979, it was published actually after she died, although she'd submitted it, her last poem. You know, was she coming out by using this word? But she actually confided in friends that this was her effort to reclaim the word gay from the gay rights movement. It was a word I found as I was reading her letters that she used quite frequently, the gay flowers, the gay... party. And it was, she cared so much about words. Another one, rainbow, you know, rainbow, rainbow, rainbow at the end of that wonderful
poem. The fish.
Fish, rainbow, rainbow, rainbow. And I let him go. You know, the Rainbow Coalition, that was all fine, but she wanted to, you know, she wanted words to retain meaning. She was also very upset about the phrase, didn't like it, to have sex. Why not making love, she said. Doesn't that say it all?
Well, you've
said sex seemed clinical to her.
You said some things I think that are very important about these love letters and the importance of these love letters. I mean, we do indeed, literary scholars pay a great deal of attention to Yeats's love letters, to Joyce's love letters, and we don't necessarily have to stay with Irish men. We certainly
exactly.
Have to,
I know it's really extraordinary, particularly in her case. You know, so much what we know about the history of gay rights and of lesbian and gay experience in America comes from activists, from people who were, you know, breaking the boundaries and wishing to go public. Elizabeth Bishop was not at all like this. And so to see these letters to her lovers, it's a window into what probably was a more general experience for women who loved women in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. More common, even though, of course, it's Elizabeth Bishop writing, there's never anything common about what she says. But the relationship at the end of her life in the 1970s, during the time that I knew her, although it was not something we knew much about, was with a much younger woman, Alice Methfessel. And the letters they exchanged, which were saved, held back until after Alice died in 2009, are just so so beautiful, so passionate, and full of Elizabeth, again, kind of marked with a sense of impending mortality, as you can imagine would be the case being involved with someone so much younger. She was fearful that Alice would decide to leave her. And
the major love of her life was this Brazilian architect woman.
Yes, Lata de Macedo Soares, not really trained as an architect, but a brilliant designer. They lived together very happily for 15 years in Brazil, both in this hill town outside of Rio called Petropolis, where Lata had property and was building this amazing modernist house that they lived in. It was being constructed around them, and Lata built Elizabeth a studio in which she could write. And then Lata also had an apartment in Rio where they spent time. It was really a marriage, and that was another thing that I discovered in letters, was how soon this commitment came. Elizabeth, I mentioned the time when she was writing at the fish houses in 1947, which was such a down time for her, and by 1950, after spending a year as the poet laureate in Washington, D.C. at the height of the Lavender Scare, just a horrible time for her. She bought a ticket to go around South America on a freighter line. She could stop as long as she wanted in any of several ports, and got only as far as Rio, where she fell in love with Lotta, and Lotta fell in love with Elizabeth, and within a month had committed to staying there, to living in this beautiful house under construction up on the mountainside. And Lotta gave her a ring inscribed with the date of their commitment to each other on the birthday, Elizabeth's birthday that followed soon after. So it was a commitment, very much a commitment. And they lived, fairly openly up in the hillside. And I think lucky for Elizabeth that she could be in Brazil in the 1950s.
And also, unfortunately, a sad ending because Lotta died of a drug overdose. And there was an attempt at some rapprochement, but it didn't work out. I want to do this. I want to bring our listeners into this, especially appreciators of Elizabeth Bishop's poetry. We'll hear her read another poem. We're talking to Megan Marshall, whose most recent book, and she's a Pulitzer Prize winner, by the way, did a biography of Margaret Fuller, now has done one of Elizabeth Bishop called A Miracle of Breakfast, which is a Sestina, and which I think was read by none other than John Ashbery at her funeral service. We do invite you to join us, and we'd like to hear from you. I should also mention that Megan Marshall will be at Book Passage at the Ferry Building tomorrow, at 6 p.m., and then Mrs. Dalloway's in Berkeley on Wednesday, March 8th at 7:30. In the meantime, we'd like to hear from you. If you have thoughts about Elizabeth Bishop, questions, comments, please feel free to join the program and the conversation. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Join us now at that number, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum. My voice is getting very fogged up here, so let's try to get that rid of. You can also, by the way, tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, or go to our Facebook page, a number of ways to join the program. And Kevin writes, Elizabeth Bishop won the 1976 Newstead International Award for Literature. Would she be considered part of the first or second wave of feminist scholars?
Well, as you know, Bishop didn't want to be considered a woman. Now, who did you say was the Neustadt Prize winner? You know, what was fascinating to me, I was listening to the recording of a reading that Elizabeth gave at the 92nd Street Y in New York. She was introduced by Mae Swenson, another gay woman poet, more open about it than Elizabeth was. And yet Mae noted sort of with approbation how this prize, the Neustadt Prize, Elizabeth was the first American and the first poet, the first woman to win this prize for all of literature.
Forgive me, Megan, wasn't she also the first woman to actually teach a course at Harvard?
She was the first woman to teach creative writing, an advanced creative writing course. Mae Sarton had a job in the early 50s, but she wasn't allowed to teach poetry.
And she only did it because Lowell kind of
extended the invitation. You know, that shows how Lowell was kind of helping and actually helping women along. And it was hard to get this information out of the Harvard English department as well. They were kind of reluctant about that. And in fact, the first time her name was in the catalog, it was Miss Blank, because she hadn't, you know, they hadn't yet signed the papers. But I think they wanted to indicate to the women students that there was going to be a woman coming along finally that you could study with. But at any rate, Mae Swenson had said that Bishop was known only through her work, unlike maybe those who were Nobel Prize winners for their literature. This Neustadt Prize was even more rarefied. I think she was trying to make that case. But to me, it was really extraordinary to have a woman poet at the head of the class. She didn't enjoy it. She was a shy person. She didn't enjoy this role particularly. And she began by saying she didn't believe poetry could be taught, which was a little bit of a downer for us. But I came to respect that really a great deal. And I think in a way my biography is a exploration of that. How is poetry learned? Can it be taught? And I think what she was really saying was you have to live your life. You have to, your poetry comes out of the life. It comes out of self-study. So much of what she learned, you know, she didn't go to college at a time when there were creative writing classes. She was self-taught. And she wanted to instill that discipline in us.
Well, I'll make a pitch for a book that had an enormous effect on me as a young man studying literature. It was John Chardy's book, How a Poem Means.
Oh, yeah.
Which to this day stays in my consciousness.
He was the one who had the job along with May Sarton. He was allowed to teach poetry. She was not at Harvard.
Yeah, that's right. Well, let's hear actually Elizabeth Bishop reading another poem. This is called Filling Station, and let's listen to her read the poem at the Library of Congress again back in 1974, and we'll continue with Megan Marshall.
Oh, but it's dirty, this little filling station, oil-soaked, oil permeated to a disturbing overall black translucency. Be careful with that match. Father wears a dirty oil-soaked monkey suit that cuts him under the arms, and several quick and saucy and greasy sons assist him. It's a family filling station, all quite thoroughly dirty. Do they live in the station? It has a cement porch behind the pumps, and on it a set of crushed and grease impregnated wickerwork. On the wicker sofa, a dirty dog, quite comfy. Some comic books provide the only note of color, of certain color. They lie upon a big dim doily draping a tabouret, part of the set, beside a big hirsute begonia. Why the extraneous plant? Why the tabouret? Why, oh why, the doily? Embroidered in daisy stitch with marguerites, I think, and heavy with gray crochet. Somebody embroidered the doily. Somebody waters the plant, or oils it, maybe. Somebody arranges the rows of cans so that they softly say, so, to high-strung automobiles, somebody loves us all.
One of my guests' favorite poems, Filling Station, read by Elizabeth Bishop, and really bringing across the kind of humor that she had.
Yeah, it's humor, but it's also kind of a secular prayer, ending with the line that she almost swallows at the end, somebody loves us all. She also said that line, so, to calm the jittery automobiles, that was something that she'd heard her grandfather and others say in Nova Scotia to calm the cattle, to calm the horse that you might be leading, and might be driving in the wagon. So. And she sort of thought people would get that, but I'm not sure she did.
What about the fact that she was a victim of sexual abuse? How important is that figure in terms of, well, her poetry and her life?
Yeah. This was another revelation in these letters to the psychoanalyst, that her Uncle George, as she said, sometimes she remembered this, sometimes she didn't, which we recognize now as kind of the language of a trauma survivor, that when she was very young, her mother had been institutionalized, her father died, she was passed from relative to relative and thought she was landing in a sort of safe place with one of her mother's aunts, but her aunt was married to Uncle George, who you can see a photograph of him in the book. She said, many people don't know what it's like to have lived with a sadist. You can sort of see it in his eyes and in his demeanor, but he had, you know, given her a bath when she first arrived at age 8 and washed her indelicately and troublingly, and she turned away from him. And later when she was older, he was always trying to catch her in a corner and feel her breast. So this was the 1920s and 30s. She didn't know how to understand this, and she saw beyond this him also kind of a verbal abuse, an abuse of her aunt who she loved and who was caring for her. Sometimes she said, you know, one of her other aunts said, well, maybe it was Uncle George that put you off men. I don't know if we can say that, but we do know that she loved women from an early age. And
it's curious because there's a shampoo love poem, really, where there's all this bathing and all this emphasis upon bathing.
Yeah, and she remembered her mother.
It's her lover.
Yeah. One of her few memories of her mother before age 5 was of watching her mother, who she considered to be very beautiful, standing in a similar tin tub in the room they shared in Nova Scotia, in the grandparents' house, and bathing herself. She loved the sight of women with their clothes off, and that's also part of the shampoo, washing her lover Lotta's long hair But yeah, you know, there's a lot to overcome. She struggled a lot, and I think we see this in the poems. You spoke about initially at the start of our part of the program about, you know, write me down as the loneliest person in the world. She was lonely, and you see that in her poems. But I think lonely people, all people, are drawn into these poems. You know, somebody loves us all. She often finds a way of out of this loneliness, out of this kind of radical isolation. One of my other favorite poems, The Moose, she talks about the moose appearing at midnight, crossing a road, stopping the bus that she's on. And she says, why do we feel, we all feel, this sweet sensation of joy?
I love that poem. Here's a tweet from a listener named Kathleen who says, I'm just parking at the library. I'm going to pick up an Elizabeth Bishop book. Thank you. And a question from another listener, what was Bishop like as a teacher, as a person? Mm. Was she funny? I think we've touched on that. But she says, I'm so jealous of your guests for having been able to interact with Miss Bishop.
She had a great sense of humor, and that's what her one of many things that her friends loved about her. It took a little while for her to warm up and show that in class. But I remember her telling an anecdote about Marion Moore, her wonderful mentor in her early days, and how Marion Moore had stolen a line from her. And this brought a lot of laughter. Elizabeth had been, this was recall. So the class was in 1976. She was recalling probably 1936, having stayed in a hotel on Cape Cod and seeing, as she described to Marion Moore, the bellboy with the buoy balls, carrying these glass balls in mesh for one of the hotel guests, and Marion Moore stole this line and used it in her poem Four Quartz Crystal Clocks. As late as 1976, Bishop was still a little bit miffed about this, although, in fact, you know, Marion Moore, one of her devices in poetry was to kind of pick up bits of dialogue and put them in. So that brought a smile. But really the best thing about the class, because she was absent a lot with asthma and having problems with her teeth. But at the end of the semester, she invited our class, which I found out later in researching her, she had thought was a rather brilliant class. That was nice to know. I'm not sure I was one of the brilliant ones. But she invited us to her apartment on Lewis Wharf at the waterfront in Boston for a party and invited some younger poets, Frank Bidart, Lloyd Schwartz, Ricardo Sternberg. They were there as well. And as well as Alice Methvessel, her partner, although, you know, Alice stayed at one end of the room. There's no public display of affection for us or anyone throughout that time. But to see her warm and beautiful and happy among friends, I think that may have set this biography in motion many years later, the sense of the, you know, two sides, many sides of Elizabeth Bishop.
Well, you get the many sides of Elizabeth Bishop in your biography. Congratulations on it. Thank you so much for joining us. I'd like to end maybe with Elizabeth Bishop defining poetry, or the poet's job, as to think with feelings and catching the mind in action. Again, pleasure to spend this time with you, Megan Marshall.
Thank you, Michael.
Megan Marshall's new book is Elizabeth Bishop, A Miracle for Breakfast, and she'll be at Book Passage at the Ferry Building tomorrow at 6, and Mrs. Dalloway in Berkeley on Wednesday, March 8th at 7:30. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. We want to thank all who are behind the scenes here, our producers, Irina Gucci, Tina Larberg, Susan Britton, and Jeremy Siegel. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer, Holly Kernan. Thank you for listening. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.